From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Tim Fleming. Sometimes it's tough to keep up with the urban sprawl and other changes in your own hometown. Imagine, then, what it must be like when those changes are sudden and catastrophic, as in San Francisco in 1906.
There was 48 seconds of very intense shaking, and then a lull for about 10 or 15 seconds, and then a second, and in many cases, rather greater shock. And so within 2 minutes, between 5:12 and 5:14 a.m. on that Wednesday morning, that's when all the damage was done.
This hour, Simon Winchester will revisit the great San Francisco earthquake. And John Berendt introduces us to that most operatic of Italian cities, Venice.
I actually came to realize that Venice has survived. It's a story of survival, not of decay.
But first, Robert Neuwirth says the cities of the future will belong to squatters. Take what's happening right now, for example, in Istanbul.
Once you have 2,000 people, you can petition the national government to be recognized as a legal sub-municipality. And what that means is that you can have legal squatter politics even though you are an illegal community.
Robert Neuwirth spent time in several squatter communities, collecting material for a book he calls Shadow Cities, A Billion Squatters, A New Urban World. Steve Paulson found his story almost unbelievable.
Are there really a billion squatters in the world today?
Well, sure. I mean, loosely, they've invaded land and built without owning that land.
But to say there are a billion squatters, I mean, that's just almost unfathomable. You're talking about, a sixth of the world's population, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, get ready, because in 25 years, that'll be 2 billion squatters, and it'll be one-fourth of the world's population. And by halfway through this century, there'll be 3 billion squatters, and that'll be better than one out of three people on the planet. 70 million people a year are leaving the rural areas and coming to the cities. And if you do the math, it's 130 people a minute arriving in the world's cities.
Wow.
So even as we've talked here, several hundred people have arrived in the world's cities and no developers building for them. No government is investing the money in creating housing that they can afford. So they take over land and build for themselves.
So you're basically talking about poor people who are moving from the countryside into the city, looking for better prospects, and they don't really have any good mm-hmm. place to live. And so they live in these shanty towns.
The big thing is cities are economic engines. People come to the cities looking for opportunity, looking for work, looking for a way to be able to have the money to raise their families. And by and large, they can get that. You can find a job in the city no matter how menial, but you can't find a place to live.
Now, there are some famous squatter communities in various cities around the world. Rio de Janeiro in Brazil is one. Mm-hmm. Their slums are infamous. Who lives there?
Regular people. The slums, I hate the word slum, but in Brazil they're called favelas, which is a word that is a throwback to 100 years ago when the first squatter communities in Rio were founded. And it's basically normal people. I mean, when you go to these communities, you find hairdressers and fruit salesmen and restaurateurs and bar owners and people who work in tourism and the people who sell you ice cream on Copacabana Beach. It's a mélange of people that are in any kind of profession that you could imagine.
So these are not slums, is what you're saying.
Well, that's the point. That's why I object to that word, because I think it's an unfortunate English translation that gives a very emotionally laden picture of these communities. There's a tremendous amount of commerce in these communities. There's a tremendous amount of activity. They have these moto taxis that you pay 50 cents and they'll take you wherever you want to go up the hill. It's a very steep hill, so, you know, if you're tired, it's definitely worth it to take the moto taxis. And it's just incredibly vibrant.
I'm trying to get my head around this. I mean, this is all an illegal community. I mean, you're talking about, I guess, tens of thousands of people, probably hundreds of thousands of people.
Well,
the
population of Hosseini is somewhere probably between 130,000 and 200,000 people.
So it's basically a city within a city, but it's all illegal, and yet they have their own economy, their own infrastructure.
Yep. That's exactly it. And they developed that over time. Look, it started out as your basic, stereotypical, horrible shanty town. It was crude mud and wood bungalows in the, you know, hidden under the canopy of the jungle for many, many years. But as people developed a sense of permanence, as they recognized that they were not going to be evicted, they took steps to improve their community. They pirated electricity from the nearby, well, not so nearby, the far away electrical poles. And once they had that, they could install pumps and pirate water. Then they rebuilt their homes out of reinforced concrete and brick. So almost all of Rocinha is actually reinforced concrete and brick townhouses. And some of the apartments are quite crude, but some of the apartments are quite stylish. The one I lived in was a three-room apartment with tile floors, electricity, a full bathroom, room for a full kitchen if I bought the appliances, and a balcony with a view of the ocean. So we're not talking about, you know, the most horrible, decrepit, degraded conditions in the universe.
So who actually runs this whole shantytown?
There you get into the netherworld. Brazil is unique. The favelas are under the control of drug gangs. It's an opportunistic infection because many, many years ago, the state and local authorities decided these people are illegal, they don't pay taxes, so we won't give them services. So there's no police or public security in the favela. And as a result, drug dealers found, hey, this is great. We can operate here with impunity. So there's a major amount of drugs, mostly destined for the foreign market, that's moved through the favela. And the drug gangs are communitarian. They protect the community, and that's a bargain that people have to accept.
So you're not talking about junkies on the street corner. You're actually talking about a safe community.
Highly organized drug gangs that are moving massive amounts of drugs, mostly wholesale, mostly destined for the U.S. and Europe, mostly cocaine and marijuana. And these drug gangs, while the local posse is run by local residents, the theory is and the suspicion is that the reach of these gangs goes up into the highest echelons of society in Brazil. Hmm. But they are communitarian and they keep the peace. There is, with a few very minor exceptions, no street crime in the favelas.
Oh, that's so fascinating, that because Rio is
very
famous for,
city.
Yes, for yeah. its crime. Yeah. If you walk yeah. around the Copacabana well, beach, you better watch out.
There's a story I tell in my book. A guy who came to Brazil to study and do parasailing. He was staying in a hotel in Copacabana, and the first week that he was there, he was mugged twice and had all his money stolen at gunpoint. And he was also beaten up during one of the muggings. And, you know, he showed up with all these bruises at his parasailing class, and the instructor asked him what happened, and he told him, and the instructor said, well, look, you know, I have some relatives who live in Rocinha, and you're going to have to put up with living in the squatter community, but I can guarantee you, you'll save money and you'll never be assaulted again for the next 3 weeks that you're here. And so he took that deal and he stayed in Rocinha and he was safe.
Now, you also spent a lot of time on the other side of the world in Istanbul, Turkey. And
yeah.
there's a big shanty town there as well. What's that like?
To tell you the truth, that's even better than the ones in Rio. Turkey's extraordinary. First of all, I'll give you the statistic. Istanbul is a city of 12 million people, and about 40% of them are squatters.
40%?
Yeah, yeah. It was a migration from the eastern part of Turkey to the city looking for work. It was the same process. But Turkey has two things that give squatters an amazing amount of stability. The first is what's called the Gece Gündüz law. And Gece Gündüz basically means built at night or it happened at night. The rule is that if you can get your structure built overnight and you're in by morning and the authorities haven't caught you, you can't be evicted without due process of law. You have to be taken to court, no matter whose property you're on. So that's number one. And there was, for many, many years, there was this wonderful nighttime cat and mouse game as the squatters would organize and they figured out how to use quick drying concrete and they would create groups and descend on a piece of property and frame it out quickly and dump the concrete in, they'd be in by morning. And if they weren't finished, then the police would come and knock everything down. I talked with one family that they tried three times. The first time they did it, it was destroyed. The second time they did it, it was destroyed. The third time they did did it, they figured out how to pay off a local politician and the police didn't come and then they were in. Hmm. But the second thing that is really unique in Turkey is that once you have 2,000 people in a locale, you can petition the national government to be recognized as a legal sub-municipality. And what that means is that you can have squatter politics, legal squatter politics, even though you are an illegal community.
You have elected officials and all of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You have an actual government. The great example is a community called Sultanbeyli, which is pretty far out on the Asian side of Istanbul. Sultanbeyli started as just one of these land invasions, like a tiny hamlet on the edge of the city. Now, it's an independent city of 300,000 people. It's got its own squatter mayor. He's popularly elected. He's got an air-conditioned office on the seventh floor of the squatter city hall. And he presides over an empire that includes a public works department, that includes garbage service, that includes street cleaning and municipal bus service. So it's a city. It has tremendous staying power, and the people there will never be evicted, because they have this sort of political entity that has figured out how to interact with the rest of the city. It's incredible. The shopping strip, Fatih Boulevard, in downtown Sultanbeyli, is several miles long, and it's all 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7-story reinforced concrete and brick buildings with tile facades, and there's restaurants and banks and car dealerships. It's a city.
Do people pay taxes?
Well, they don't specifically pay what you would call property taxes, but when they want to build, they have to pay a sort of approval fee to the municipality. And that's part of how the municipality generates its budget. So if they want to knock down a single-story building and build something bigger, they have to pay a fee to get that approval. And I have some friends there who are very incensed by that. My friend Zaman Han said, "That's a bribe. Why should I have to pay that?" But most people pay it. And it has generated public services that make the community better.
So this is a place that works, is what it sounds like.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a city that works. No question about it. And now, because it has a government, it has been able to negotiate with what's called the Büyükşehir, or big city government of Istanbul, mayor of the entire city of Istanbul, to bring water and sewers to every home in Sultanbeyli. So now it's pretty much indistinguishable from any legal neighborhood of the city.
You're describing a global phenomenon where more and more cities around the world are going to have more and more squatters. And I guess I'm wondering if new kinds of cities are being created in the process.
Well, they definitely are. The squatter communities that I lived in function as sort of separate enclaves, if you will, right now. They haven't been integrated into the city as a whole. And they develop their own cultures. They develop their own music. I mean, the kids in the favelas in Rio listen to what they call funk and hip-hop, which is sort of the Brazilian version of gangsta rap combined with the Miami bass sound of the 1980s. And it's a very vigorous and vibrant music, although it can be really crude. And they have their own culture that way. You know, they're not sitting around listening to samba and, you know, the famous music that we think of as Brazilian popular music. They know it because they hear it on TV, but that's not what they're listening to. And so these communities are creating their own cultures and their own political cultures as they become more savvy in how to interact with the rest of society. So yes, I do think that they are creating the cities of the future, and those cities of the future will be somewhat different from the cities that we take for granted now.
Robert Neuwirth calls his book Shadow Cities, A Billion Squatters, A New Urban World. Talked with Steve Paulson. This is hip-hop music from the favela in Rio. We'll meet the squatters William Gibson sees in San Francisco's future, coming right up. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. One of the uses of speculative fiction is to play what-if with problems that seem too intractable to tackle in the real world. In the future world techno-wizard William Gibson conjured, earthquakes tore the city of San Francisco apart. Squatters constructed a fantastic warren of dwellings and workplaces on top of what was once the Bay Bridge. Let's join one of the characters from Gibson's novel, Virtual Light. He's just about to enter what's become of the bridge.
The integrity of its span was rigorous as the modern program itself. Yet around this had grown another reality, intent upon its own agenda. This had occurred piecemeal to no set plan, employing every imaginable technique and material. The result was something amorphous, startlingly organic. At night, illuminated by Christmas bulbs, by recycled neon, by torchlight, it possessed a queer medieval energy. By day, seen from a distance, it reminded him of the ruin of England's Brighton Pier, as though viewed through some cracked kaleidoscope of vernacular style. Its steel bones, its stranded tendons, were lost within an accretion of dreams. Tattoo parlors, gaming arcades, dimly lit stalls stacked with decaying magazines. Sellers of fireworks, of cut bait. Betting shops, sushi bars, unlicensed pawnbrokers. Herbalists, barbers, bars. Dreams of commerce. Their locations generally corresponded with the decks that had once carried vehicular traffic, while above them, rising to the very peaks of the cable towers, lifted the intricately suspended barrio, with its unnumbered population and its zones of more private fantasy. Rain-silvered plywood, broken marble from the walls of forgotten banks, corrugated plastic, polished brass, sequins, painted canvas, mirrors, chrome gone dull, and peeling in the salt air. So many things, too much for his reeling eye. He entered it now, and found his way to a coffee shop, whose interior had the texture of an ancient fairy, dark dented varnish over plain heavy wood, as if someone had sawn it, entire, from some tired public vessel. Which was entirely possible, he thought, seating himself at the long counter. Toward Oakland, past the haunted island, the wingless carcass of a 747, house the kitchens of 9 Thai restaurants.
That excerpt from William Gibson's novel Virtual Light was read by Charles Monroe Kane. When people in California talk about the big one, they're sharing their worries about something that hasn't happened yet. But they're remembering San Francisco in 1906. Between the earthquake and the fire that followed, there was almost total devastation in the city. Simon Winchester tells the story in a book called A Crack in the Edge of the World. The real problems came, he says, not from the quake, but from what happened next.
Two things happened. The fire chief was killed, Dennis Sullivan, died in his fire station, scalded to death by steam from a broken radiator. So the fire department was leaderless, but much more important than that, it was waterless, because all the water mains ruptured, and they were completely powerless to do anything about it. And so some very tough decisions had to be made about how to deal with this fire. And that, to my mind, is the most extraordinary thing about what happened, particularly when you compare the reaction of officialdom to what has recently happened after Katrina.
Well, speaking of officialdom, in San Francisco, there was, prior to the 1906 earthquake, pretty broad corruption in the city, which can't have done the city any good when the moment came when it needed most to have a leadership structure.
Well, you wouldn't have thought so. And yet, quite the reverse happened. I mean, just very briefly what occurred. The earthquake happened at 5:12 a.m. on that Wednesday morning. One of the people bounced out of bed was a pretty appalling soldier called Frederick Funston, who had essentially been demoted after a pretty appalling career of violence and brutality in the Philippines, brought back to America and given the job as number two in the San Francisco garrison. The number one, General Greeley, was away at his daughter's wedding. Funston was bounced out of bed and realized instantly he needed to act. So he didn't care about the legality of what he was doing. He wrote a note to his adjutant down at the Presidio, sent someone on a horse galloping down there and said, summon all available soldiers, put them in full battle gear, march them through the ruins and the fires, and make them available to the mayor of the city. I mean, you can't these days just casually give federal troops into the custody of a city mayor, but Funston did. 2 hours and 33 minutes after the first shaking, two companies of soldiers, bayonets fixed, ammunition, marching with a tremendous shot of confidence for the bewildered and frightened citizenry, they marched through the ruins, presented themselves to the mayor, a man who, as you say, highly corrupt. I mean, he was a man called Eugene Schmitz. He was perpetually on the take. He was a violinist in a city jazz band. He was a president of the local musicians' union. Not at all the sort of person who you think would rise to the occasion, but he did, like Funston. He saw the soldiers. He said, equally illegally, right, we need to control law and order. I'm issuing an order. Anyone that loots will be, by these soldiers, shot dead. Looting stopped in a heartbeat. I want from these soldiers as much dynamite as we can lay our hands on, because we need to create fire breaks to stop this inferno spreading. He got his dynamite. And we need to commandeer a boat, send it over to Oakland, where I suspect the telegraph lines are working. They weren't in San Francisco. And send a message out saying San Francisco's been hurt and we need help. And that message went out to Washington. Teddy Roosevelt in the White House, William Taft, his Secretary of War, responded with astonishing speed. I mean, Congress was cajoled into meeting at 4 o'clock the next morning. Five relief trains were ordered thundering their way westwards within that day. The first relief train actually arrived from Southern California at midnight on the night of the earthquake itself. Within a week, every single tent in the possession of the American Army was pitched in San Francisco, providing housing. I mean, astonishingly fast reaction.
It is, and I guess the lesson isn't clear from this, although maybe the lesson is clear, that we need people who will act without regard to...
The legality. I think that's one of the problems, yeah. That this... We're not here to talk about Katrina, I know, but everyone was looking over their shoulders, is what I'm about to do legal? And it inhibits people from taking the kind of bold decisions that in the moment of a catastrophe seemed to be necessary.
And those things were done then by two people you have no admiration for in any other way, the mayor of San Francisco and the second in command of the Presidio.
Precisely. But there were people that also, in the sort of lesser and less well-sung roles, who also performed kindly. And I think of the postmaster of San Francisco, a man called Arthur Fisk, who equally illegally issued an order. He realized that the victims of this disaster needed to inform their loved ones of their condition, but possibly wouldn't be able to afford postage stamps, or perhaps couldn't even find them in the ruins. So he issued an order which went to every post office in San Francisco saying, any letter or card posted into the San Francisco postal system, which clearly comes from the hand of a victim and does not bear a stamp, shall not go undelivered for want of fee.
How did the city begin to recover? Because this is not something from which you can do anything with all the best of intentions and all the help in the world in any very immediate fashion.
Well, it was a classic example of the business of San Francisco is business. I mean, it was a city that its commercial baronies decided it's got to get back onto its feet pretty quickly. And in doing so, they passed up a chance for the city to become architecturally one of the gems of America, because there was this town planner called Daniel Burnham, who essentially had mapped out Washington, D.C. I mean, the mall and all those things in Washington are part of Burnham's great scheme. Burnham was commissioned in 1904, 1905 to lay out a plan for San Francisco, which after all, after its gold rush rambunctiousness, had really achieved the role of the imperial city. I mean, this was the city from where the Great White Fleet went westwards to dominate the Pacific, to have the colony in the Philippines, to trade with China, trade with Japan. America wanted a grand city on the West Coast. And so Burnham was called in to design one. And his design, which was oddly enough delivered to the mayor of San Francisco the day before the earthquake, was full of great boulevards and fountains and reflecting pools and statuary. It would have been a grand city. But they didn't. They immediately said, no, we can't be bothered with all this marble and all this folderol. We must rebuild the city on the old lot lines and just get back to work. And so they did. And within 2 years, you'd almost not know that the city had been hurt. And it was.
But was there at least any effort made by the people who rebuilt the city to make it stronger, make it better, make it different from the city that it had been before? Because you have to assume, having one of these events, there could be one day another.
Yes, and it has to be said that the California Earthquake Commission, under the leadership of this scientist called Andrew Lawson, did determine that he identified and indeed named the San Andreas Fault and realized that that was the mischief maker that caused all the problems and that it was likely to cause a problem again. But they did make the building stronger and they did take precautions. They built flexibility into the fire water system and they put big tanks under the road junctions. But the die was essentially cast because it coincided, the post-earthquake period, with the ascendancy of Los Angeles to the south. And there is one harsh reality, leaving aside the economic reasons for why Los Angeles became big, which was, of course, the film industry. The reason why Los Angeles became the capital of California, I mean, the economic capital, obviously not the political capital, derives from a simple reality, that San Francisco lies exactly on top of the San Andreas Fault and therefore is theoretically prone for the rest of its existence to earthquakes, whereas Los Angeles has a swarm of lesser faults, but the San Andreas, the big mother, is 50 miles to the east, runs through, you know, Indian Wells and Palm Springs and places like that. It does not run through Los Angeles. And so Los Angeles is, in relative terms, a much, much safer place.
Is the world a safer place for this event having happened and been so clearly recorded?
No. Because of the cool indifference of the world to humankind, we now know why earthquakes occur. We know why earthquakes occur in California. The Pacific plate moving northwards at 1.5 inches a year, scraping past the North America plate, friction not allowing it to for decades, and then suddenly it moves and that causes an earthquake. But knowing this does not allow us to predict, and that's the big problem. And when Art Agnos, one of the mayors of San Francisco, said rather testily to a geologist, look, you people are always going on about how dangerous our place is. Until you can give us 24 hours notice of an earthquake, just go away and be quiet. But the earth has got this massive indifference and will keep on moving. And if we choose to place cities on top of the places where it does move, then we better woe betide.
But if in all your research you haven't discovered by now that people will want to live in a place as beautiful as San Francisco, even if there is the danger of an earthquake, but every morning they get to look at one of the most beautiful spots on earth, well, then you haven't learned very much, have
well,
you?
Well, indeed, we certainly haven't. But there is a sort of broader reality, which I find very interesting, that in sort of old countries in the world, I mean, the European nations and Asian countries, our great cities are where time suggests that it's reasonable for them to be there. I mean, London, Paris, Moscow, Peking, Berlin. They're thousands of years old, and they're in seismically stable places, not afflicted by extremes of weather. And so it's reasonable that they should stay there. But by the same token, these same countries are littered with the ruins of cities that were built where they should not have been built, like Pompeii and Herculaneum and Petra and Heliopolis and Ayutthaya in Thailand. And we as tourists go and look at them and are awe-inspired and look at these ruins and amazed at the civilizations that built them, and we wonder idly why they're not major cities anymore. America, though, is a country without any ruins. It's got a few ghost towns in the West, but it has no ruined cities because America is young enough that it can put its cities down where it jolly well pleases, except for this cool indifference of the planet. And I wonder whether in 200 years' time, if you look at a map of the United States, whether there might not actually be some ruins that tourists go and visit. One of them, of course, obviously New Orleans, which when you think about it, it is sort of stupid to build a city 20 feet below sea level between a river and a lake in a part of the world that's afflicted by constant hurricanes. Similarly, Phoenix, Tucson, even Las Vegas. I mean, there is no water there. Sooner or later, that reality is going to catch up with people, and I cannot imagine, I mean, not many world cities are built in the middle of deserts. I can't imagine tourists going to see the ruins of Phoenix in future years and, you know, being awe-inspired by the relics
by
of Walmart or something. But then what of San Francisco? I mean, a very, very dangerous part of the world. Can it survive? I think it can if it learns a lesson from Japan. That's the one world country that has learned to accommodate to earthquakes.
Well, and Japan has had no choice if it wishes to continue to be a country, because there are no seismically stable places on the Japanese islands.
Well, precisely, and yet it has managed to. It has managed to live to accommodate. It has competent people in every prefecture, every city. It's got emergency supplies. Its buildings are toughly built, and its people are trained, relentlessly trained, on what to do in the event that the earth starts shaking. In California, regrettably, they're still in denial. It's far too easy just to open another bottle of Sauvignon Blanc and pretend they're not there.
Simon Winchester's book is called A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906. Later on, John Barrett takes us to the city that's been drowning for decades, but somehow never quite goes under. And we'll hear a Venetian love story. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Italian journalist Andrea de Robilant comes from an old Venetian family. Their palazzo on the Grand Canal is gone, the art and antiques sold off generations ago. But Andrea still remembers the day his father found a carton of old family letters in the attic. They were love letters, dating back to the 1750s. Some pages were written in a secret code. Some were tear-stained. They contained a remarkable love story. It was the tale of Andrea's ancestor, a young Venetian nobleman named Andrea de Memmo, and a beautiful Anglo-Venetian girl named Giustiniana Wynne. During the waning years of the Venetian Republic, they carried on a passionate and doomed love affair. Andrea de Robilant has pieced together their story in a book called, simply, A Venetian Affair, and Strange Champs asked him to share it with us.
Andrea, why don't you start by setting the scene for us, if you would. This story takes place in Venice, the 1750s. What's going on? What's it like?
Well, it's a fascinating moment, I think, because the Venetian Republic was declining very fast from a political point of view. But at the same time, it was an extraordinary period for the arts. All the great painters of the Settecento Veneziano were painting, from Canaletto to the Tiepolos to Guardi. There was wonderful music. It was a very festive moment in Venetian history. So one has to picture the city as this, really this stage with a lot of things going on, and Andrea and Giustiniana carrying on their secret love affair against this backdrop.
My Giustiniana, yesterday I tried desperately to see you. Before lunch, there were no gondoliers. After lunch, I went looking for you in Campo Santo Stefano. Nothing. Finally, I found you in the Piazza San Marco. I sent Alvisetto ahead to find out whether you were on your way to the opera, so I could rush over and get a box in time. Then I waited for you, filled with desire.
My darling Memmo, Friday we shall meet, but my God, how the time in between will seem interminable. And afterward, what? Afterward, I shall think about our next meeting so that I shall always be having sweet thoughts about you. Oh, I do love you, my Memmo. Oh, by the way, I have news. My mother received a marriage proposal for me from a very rich Roman gentleman. Isn't it terrible, Memmo? Aren't you at least a little bit jealous? And what if he is as nice as they say? And what if my mother wanted him? Oh, I can't go on, not even in jest. I am all yours, my love.
Andrea belonged to one of the most prominent Venetian families, and it was a very closed caste, and he was expected to marry someone from that caste in an arranged marriage. And Giustiniana not only was not of his rank, as it were, but she was also an illegitimate child. And very quickly, the families bore down on them and told them that it would be impossible for them to see each other, and Giustiniana's mother told Andrea never to come to the house again, never to speak to her, never to write to her. And so much of the book is really the story of their secret encounters and all the network of informers and messengers they had to set up in order to be able to see each other. But basically, it's this wonderful game of hide-and-seek played out in the streets and the theaters and the gambling houses of Venice.
Touch your hair if you're going to the Ridotto.
Come by the canal, as my mother doesn't want me to go out.
Nod or shake your head to tell me whether you plan to go to the piazza.
When shall I see you? Are you as impatient as I am?
My God, Justiniana, we're completely mad. If only you knew how afraid I am that your mother might find out we're seeing each other again.
I've made arrangements. Tomorrow, my dear Memo, tomorrow we shall be together. And what in the whole world could be more natural between two people who love each other than to be together?
Did they consummate their affair?
Oh, my God, yes. I mean, they were very sexual and very intense. I mean, you can feel it in the letters. They just couldn't get their hands away from each other. And so they would meet in secret alcoves in the dead of winter in freezing cold sheets. And when they were not doing it, they were writing letters to each other about doing it.
When it was clear that there was no legitimate future for them and they couldn't marry, they concocted this scheme to marry Justiniana off to an older man. Will you tell me about that?
One of the schemes they devise is for Justiniana to marry the old consul, the British consul, in whose house they had met.
How old was he?
Well, he was about 80 years old. He was very delighted at the idea of marrying the beautiful Justiniana, and Andrea worked very hard to make it happen because he thought that if Justiniana were married off to the consul would quickly die, she would be a widow, and they would be able to live out, as he says, their love's apotheosis.
By God, Justiniana, the only way to bring this to a happy conclusion is through Smith. And we are lucky because he's old, because he's rich, because he is my friend. Because he's vain, because he's crazy, and because he has everything that we can possibly need. Believe me, it takes time to seduce an old cat and then play him for a sucker. But now I know I've prepared everything well, and that I've brought him closer to us, and that he loves us all the more, and that he trusts us. I've made a great deal of progress, and I hope at last we shall be happy.
But alas, that fails because the consul finds out that he's the object of a very Machiavellian scheme, and that causes great scandal in Venice and puts Justiniana in a very difficult position.
And so Justiniana, at that point, her mother decided her hopes of marriage were completely ruined, and they were ruined in Venice, and she packed up her family and left. Did the lovers believe they were parting forever then?
No, not at all. In fact, they started scheming immediately afterwards.
And yet, during all this time, Justiniana has a terrible secret.
Yes, she is pregnant. She has been pregnant for several months. In fact, she left Venice and was already pregnant. Now, around this whole episode of the pregnancy, Casanova, who was a very close friend of both of them, does write about it in his memoirs. He doesn't mention Justiniana by name. He uses an acronym, Mademoiselle XCV. But he tells the story in great detail, also because he played a large role in it, in the sense that Justiniana wrote to Casanova, who is then also in Paris, begging him to help her get an abortion. And it's a very poignant, moving letter of a woman in tremendous distress.
I am putting my life, my reputation, my whole being in your hands. Here it is, dear Casanova. I am pregnant, and I shall kill myself if I am found out. No one knows about this, and the very author of my misery has been kept in the dark. I have managed to hide my secret so far, but I will not be able to deceive the world much longer. My belly will begin to show. And my mother, so proud and unreasonable, what will she do with me if she learns the truth? Casanova, dearest, please do your best to help me find a surgeon, a doctor, who will lift me out of my misery by delivering me with whatever remedy, and if necessary, by force. I do not fear pain, and as for payment, promise anything. I trust you, I have only you in the whole world.
Oh, Casanova, if only you knew how much I have wept. What happened? Did she have the baby?
She did. She had the baby, and alas, we've lost all track of birth records and so on. And I think the reason is that I was told, I went looking for records in the convents around Paris, and I was told that most of those documents were burnt during the French Revolution and that it would be practically impossible to find them today.
From Paris, Giustiniana and her family went to London, where they tried to enter London English society, but, you know, without much luck. And Giustiniana was often ill during those years, and she and Andrea still wrote. But it's not really clear exactly what they were to each other as the years dragged on and they still weren't together.
You know, it's when you try to keep a love affair alive through letters, even though you were apart, and it's difficult because the emotions are there, but it's also partly a fantasy. Of course, as time went by, things happened to them. Andrea had other women, she had her own stories, but the feelings remained very strong and very deep, and both of them, during the course of their life, continued to say and to write. Well, Andrea would write that Giustiniana had been the greatest lover of his life, and Giustiniana also told people that, of course, Andrea had been the great lover of her life. And when I finished writing the book, I found a letter written by Andrea's daughter, Lucia, and it's a very touching letter. She describes, Andrea is now an old man, and Giustiniana is dying in her bed, and Andrea goes to see her and sits by her the whole night and holds her hand, and he is absolutely racked by despair. And it's a very moving letter even to read it today.
They both became very admirable people, don't you think? I mean, that was the feeling I was left with at the end. I mean, they started out so high-spirited and immature in a way, and they became such
accomplished people, yeah. Well, that's why, in retrospect, their love story becomes all the more important, because they became, I think, very fulfilled and relevant figures of their period. He became a very important politician in Venice, and she had a salon in Padova. She had many, many friends, important friends, diplomats, politicians, scientists, artists. She wrote journalism, wonderful reportages that are very readable today.
She became a modern woman in some sense.
She certainly did. In a sense that Andrea was not. His destiny was clearly linked to the destiny of the Venetian Republic, and he knew it. I remember my publisher, Sonny Mehta, saying, when I showed him the proposal to write the book, he said, "Oh, this is wonderful. This is the story of the death of Venice." And I thought it was a strange thing to say, a strange comment to give about a love story, but I think he had it exactly right. I mean, it is, in a way, a metaphor for the death of Venice and Venice's inability to rise to the occasion, as it were, and make it possible for these two people to love each other and live together.
Write long letters to me. Be my friend always. Love me as much as you can. I owe you so much. I feel close to you and all those things to which my soul will always be most sensitive. Farewell, my love. Take care of yourself for me. For Giustiniana.
The story of Giustiniana and Andrea de Memmo is told in a book, A Venetian Affair, written by Andrea's descendant, the Italian journalist Andrea de Robilant. He spoke with N. Strange Champs. Our thanks to actors Colleen Madden and Jim Burns of American Players Theatre for bringing Andrea and Giustiniana's letters to life. If you think passionate operatic spectacles are limited to the Venetian past, think again. Or pick up a book called The City of Falling Angels by John Barrand. His first book was called Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. It profiled the city of Savannah and spent years on the bestseller list. The new book takes on Venice and Venetians. And as John Barrett told Anne Strainchamps, the city's old magic is still there.
The sensation of being in Venice is like being back in the 15th and 16th centuries. No cars. It is a theatrical setting. You think you're on the stage in a drama. Venice does look like a stage set. So I think this encourages people who live in Venice to act out their dramas, to embellish, to create their own imaginary selves.
Well, Venice itself is a city in which it's hard to kind of get at the truth of the city. I mean, in so many different ways, because that's the subtext of your book, really. For instance,
yes.
This idea, I think, that tourists for several centuries now have had of Venice as crumbling, the decaying, dying city. Is that what you would say about Venice, or did you discover that that's kind of one of the stories?
I actually came to realize that Venice has survived. It's a story of survival, not of decay.
What about the famous Aqua Altas, the rising water, the fear that Venice is just slowly sinking into the ocean?
Venice was sinking. For 30 years in the 20th century, they were pumping water from under Venice for drinking water, and then they realized they were sucking the city down. They lost about a foot, and they stopped doing that. The sinking isn't the problem now. It's the rising sea level that's the problem. Still, they have plans to build dikes that are movable, that can come up from the bottom of the lagoon and block the three entrances to the lagoon from the Adriatic Sea, block out the sea when the tide is too high. They've been arguing about that solution for 25 years. Eventually, something will be done, but they haven't started building yet.
One of the stories you tell in the book, it's really kind of the keynote story around which a lot of others revolve, is about the destruction of one of the most revered pieces of Venetian history, La Fenice, Venice's famous opera house. Will you, first of all, explain the kind of almost mythic status that the Fenice has in Venice?
Well, the Fenice was the opera house where five of Verdi's operas made their debut, and literally scores of other operas did too. It was one of the birthplaces of opera. Venice once had 12 opera houses, all operating at the same time. With this fire, however, they didn't have any left. And it was a devastating blow. Furthermore, and this is worse, they discovered without the Fenice, they didn't have any major stage in Venice for live performances. So they were faced with the actuality of being a dead city.
How is it that the Fenice came to burn in the first place?
Well, that was the big question right after the fire. And the prosecutor assumed at first that it was a combination of negligence and an accident. The Fenice had been closed, actually, when the fire happened. It was undergoing renovation all throughout the building. There had been stacks of flammable material next to all kinds of solvents, and it was very, very bad. The whole thing could have gone up in smoke, and he assumed that that's what had happened. Someone had tossed a cigarette or whatever. But then there began to be suspicions that perhaps this had been set, because there were a lot of mysterious coincidences. The canals around the Fenice had been drained of water shortly before the renovation began, because the city wanted to dredge the canals, clean them. Fire chief had warned the mayor, if you're going to drain the canals around the Fenice, at least find an alternate source of water should there be a fire.
Yeah, because they use the water from the canals.
Exactly.
Right. They don't have a fire hydrant system.
They don't have hydrants, and they use the canal water. Exactly. And he didn't take action. So that struck some people as perhaps suspicious. The smoke alarm had been disconnected the night of the blaze. And finally, the experts, in looking at all of the evidence, were convinced that there had been arson involved, that someone had set this fire on purpose.
But this turned into, I mean, a sort of typically theatrical event, the debate over the arson. There were a couple of electricians who were finally taken into custody. But it all played out like a soap opera, didn't it?
It did. And it's remarkable. The Italian justice system is quite different from ours. the prosecutor, who was quite a fascinating man, he developed a theory that there were two electricians working in the Fenice who were behind in their work, and they were going to be fined. And the theory is that the electricians, the two of them, set the blaze in order to destroy their own work area, not the whole theater, just so they wouldn't have to make the deadline and pay the fine. There was another theory that went along with that one, and that was that the two electricians were paid by some unknown people to burn the whole Fenice so that those people, whoever they were, could help in the rebuilding of the Fenice and make a lot of money that way. And as it turned out, the two young men were convicted. The evidence was, at first, it wasn't overwhelming, but it got to be. However, when the sentence was passed, the judge made a public remark that amazed me. He said, these two young men were not alone. There were others in the shadows. It astonished me because there had been no charges, and so I went to see the judge, and he said, that's the way we feel. We don't have the evidence, but it seems to us that that's what happened. I went to see the prosecutor. He said, yes, I have a strong suspicion that these two young men were paid, but the link between them and the money is one man, and he has just died. I don't have enough evidence to pursue it. And I said, so you're going to drop it? He said, unfortunately, we have to.
So now it's going to become yet another of the mysteries that adds to the aura of Venice.
The ambiguities. Edith Wharton, I forget the line, but she mentioned that Americans had, in America, a clear air of certainty. The Europeans dwell in ambiguities. And we're not satisfied with a non-answer or a partial answer. They're very used to it. They don't see life in black and white the way we tend to. Much more subtle.
John Barron's book about Venice is called The City of Falling Angels. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, or check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a recording of the program, just call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 11A, Evolving Cities. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Anne Strangechamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.